My name's Dick Kessler, and I'm an alcoholic. And am I grateful to be here tonight? That's the longest introduction I believe I've ever had in my life. I've been to 2 county fairs and a hog calling, I'll tell you. Seriously, first, I want to thank everybody because truly, it is a pleasure for me to be here tonight. And it is, it's good to be here with old friends, and some of them real old, some of them of long duration, and some of them new friends. And I know that my wife and I this weekend have made some friends that are going to last the rest of our lives. You know, there's a part in the big book that says after you get to step 11, it talks about the fellowship that you're going to enjoy in this program, and it says you will not want to miss that. And that's true. I don't want to miss it. And this is what it means to me. And Jim Hawkins told me years ago that if I ever cleaned up my act, that him and Drysdale would see if they couldn't get me to Mount Eagle to speak, but that I was going to have cleaned up my act and I couldn't say no cuss words. But once you get up here, you can do whatever you want to do. And Hawkins and George plotted against me all day. They tried to make me nervous. They have threatened me. They said they were going to be prepared that I would, if I got sick or ill or got to feeling jittery, that they would be willing to get up here and take right over for me. And George, right up till the time before they getting ready to introduce me, kept encouraging me to go back to my room and lay down. Tell you, if you're not nervous when you come here, you will be by the time they get done with you. My wife asked me if I was nervous, somebody asked me if I was nervous, and I said, no, I'm not nervous. And she said, it's hard to be nervous when you're egotistical and self-centered. I don't know who she was talking about. I got to tell you one little story about, Jim Hawkins and I have truly been friends for a long, long time, and we have worked together professionally for 15, 16 years now, I guess, teaching different things to different people all over this country, and mostly in this field of chemical dependency. You know, the big book says, it says that one day we hope that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous can bring a better understanding of alcoholism to the world. And I believe that. I believe that each one of us is supposed to carry the message to whoever we can carry the message to, our doctors, our lawyers, or whoever. But years ago, Jim and I were in, not too many, about 4 or 5 years ago, we were in Hong Kong. And Jim found some beautiful material over there. It really was gorgeous. And he brought it back to Birmingham, have a suit made. And it really was gorgeous material. And he paid a lot of money for Jim is $12.50. So he took it to the tailor there and asked the tailor if he could make him a suit. And he said that he took all the measurements and everything, and Jim said to give him a call. So about a week, the tailor called him, and he said, Mr. Hawkins, I can make you a sport coat, or I could make you one pair of slacks. He said, but there's no way that there's enough material here to make a suit. He said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, I want a suit out of it. He said, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Hawkins, there's just not enough material here to make this suit. And so the tailor called me and he said, do you know anybody up in Denver? And I said, well, I've got a tailor up here that is pretty good. I'll send it to me and I'll take it to him. And he sent it up there to me and I took it over to Taylor. A few days later, this tailor called me and he said, does Mr. Hawkins want one pair of pants or two pair of pants? And I said, well, I don't understand. I thought there wasn't enough material. He said, well, obviously, Mr. Hawkins is not near as big shot up here in Denver as he is down there in Alabama. All joking aside, I do want to thank you for having me here tonight. And this is the first time that my wife and I have ever been on the same program together, and we appreciate that. It means a lot when you can bring a couple together like that. I think it doesn't only make the conference better, it makes the relationship better between the man and wife. And And I tell you, it's nice for me for a change in my life. I've had a few wives, and she's had a few husbands. I am not the one that she stabbed with the butcher knife. But I want you to know, it's nice for me to be with somebody I can be proud of, you know, and that makes me feel good. That really does make me feel good. I'm going to talk to you a little bit tonight about, try to talk very little about drinking, because I'm assuming that most of you know how to do that. And if you don't, probably you'll learn. We'll talk about a little bit about what happened, and then we're going to talk some about recovery and what it's meant to me and how I go about that. I, too, have been sober for a while. The old man that helped sober me up, he said he wouldn't be my sponsor, and he never officially was. He made me go out and get sponsors all the time, but he was truly my sponsor. And he said, you will always wear a tie when you talk. And he said the reason that is because you need to be an example to the people that there is hope. If you can stay sober, anybody can stay sober. And you will also wear a tie when your wife speaks, because out of respect for her. And he always told me that. And although I hate to wear ties, I always do it. I always do it. And the other thing he told me is, he said, you always tell the people when you had your last drunk, because if you forget it, you ain't had it yet. So April 3rd, 1969 was the last time that I found it necessary to take a drink. I heard an old boy tell that in Nebraska one time at the Cornhusker State Convention. I was speaking up there, and he spoke Friday night, and he said, haven't found it necessary to take a drink such and such a time. And everybody clapped, and he said, but I have. But it wasn't necessary. And I'm here to tell you that since April 3rd, 1969, it wasn't necessary, and I didn't do it, thank goodness. So here I am tonight. I hear a lot of discussion about, what causes alcoholism and where you get it and all that kind of stuff. And I can guarantee you I did not get my alcoholism off a bar stool. I can guarantee you that. I know where I got my alcoholism. People used to come up to me when I was 10 years old and 8 years old and 9 years old, and they say, gee, Dick, you act just like your dad did when he was your age. And I had never met my dad. My dad left to fight the Great War when my mother was pregnant, and he forgot to come home. He stayed out in Nevada somewhere and got drunk and never did come home. I never did see the man until I was 15 years old. So what made me act like him? How come I was acting like he was when he was my age? Well, I know now. He died when he was 49 years old from acute alcoholism, and he had 5 brothers, and 4 of them died before they reached 50 from acute alcoholism. And I'm right now, outside of one uncle I've got, him and I are the oldest 2 Kessler males that have lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, and we're the only 2 don't drink. So there must be some correlation there, and I don't know what it is, but I'm not willing to go back and find out, I'll tell you that. My mother's side of the family, there's 7 kids in her family, and 5 of them are alcoholics, and 2 of them are merry alcoholics all the time, and the rest of them are alcoholics. So I come by my disease honestly. And you know, with an alcoholic, you always say, I believe I was alcoholic first time I ever take a drink, you know. I know I was alcoholic, and the first time I ever take a drink, it did something to me that was unbelievable. God, you know, is like Jan was saying last night, it just made me feel so good. It got rid of it, and maybe it made me sick or whatever, but it made me something that I wasn't, and that's what I was looking to be. I was looking for anything that I wasn't. Because I didn't like who I was and what I was, because I didn't feel good. I felt bad all the time. I don't know if any of you ever been the new kid in school. Well, you know, I went to 14 different schools before I ever started to high school, and I was always the new kid in school. And I was always fatty, and I was always big, you know, when I started to high school in 9th grade. I was 15 years old, and I was an even 6 foot and weighed 200 pounds. And I was just always bigger until I got to the point. That's not good when you're in the little grade, but when you get bigger, it ain't too bad. Because when people make names, call you names, stuff, then you can hit them. You know, and my drinking kind of paralleled country and western music, and I know none of you probably know anything about country and western music down this country, but we have it out in Colorado. And, you know, there's a song that 16 Tons says, Fighting in Trouble was my middle name. And that was my middle name. That's just who I was. You know, I would walk up to a bar, and I wouldn't walk in a bar. I'd kick the door open, and I'd say, I can whip any SOB in the joint. That'll get you hurt bad, let me tell you something. And My body you see me limping around here, my body is rejecting me. I'm starting to get it replaced, though. The 27th of this month, I go in and get a new knee put in, and I told him, just start there and work up. Anything that, just before I left Denver, I got 7 new teeth in the front out of an old plate. I mean, I lost them years ago. This one is a Budweiser bottle, and this one is a Coors bottle, and I only got 1 kidney because I said something unkind to an Indian one night in Shears, Nevada, and he removed it for me, and a third of my stomach's gone, and my doctor said I look like I've been in a knife fight with a fan, my body. And it wouldn't have been so bad, but I got stabbed once, 2 times in the same exact spot. And so that's the way my life was. It was just like that. And that's not a good way to live. Let me tell you something. It's not a good way to live. And I thought I was doing life on the installment plan. Every time I'd wake up, I was in jail somewhere, you know. And I wouldn't even remember how I got in jail sometimes. I'd wake up and there'd be a bail bond slip in my pocket, and I'd read it, and it said I'd been in jail and paid my $17.20 and got out, and I don't even remember being there. Don't even remember it. And so that's the way my life was going, constantly getting worse and worse and worse. And in January 1968, I decided that something had to be done. You see, I was 28 years old at that time, and when I'd been 23, I'd been put in the nut house for the first time. And I don't know about any of you if you've ever been in a nut house or not, but back in the 60s, the way they used to treat drunks, they'd just throw them in the nut house. And they zapped me with 1,500 milligrams of Thorazine a day. Now, I don't know if you ever had Thorazine or not, but it's, you do a walk. They call it the Thorazine shuffle. You know, you just kind of walk along like that. And you're walking down the hall, and all of a sudden you say, did somebody say something to me, or did I dream it, or was that last night? And you don't know. And it's hard to stay awake. You sit down, you go to sleep. And at DeWitt State Hospital in Auburn, California, they had these things that we used to load cattle with when I was driving truck called cattle prods, and had batteries in them. If you go to sleep, they'd come up and gently nudge you with a cattle prod about that long. And I'm going to tell you something, those things will knock the fire out of you. And if you're sleeping, and you weren't allowed to sleep on one side, and this is the truth. This you talk about how we treat people, you know. I always said that one of these days societies are going to be judged on how we treat our sick people. And I'll tell you, if that's the case, our society back in the 60s was awful sick, and they're in deep trouble, boy. Because I know some of them people, when they got up there and they had to answer to my higher power for the way they treated me, they're in deep ginshi, I'll tell you that, because they treated me bad. And, of course, you know, I should probably tell you how I got in that place. I had a problem with authority. I don't know if anybody in here ever had trouble with authority or not, but you know, you didn't even have to say nothing to me. If you had a badge on, we had problems. And if you walked in the bar and you had a badge on, you were my meat. And I didn't care that you was carrying a gun or what you was doing. If I could get behind you with a cue stick, you were down. And I'm serious. And that's a terrible thing to say today, but that's the way it was. And I had worked this officer over with the cue stick in North Highlands, California. And the judge gave me 2 years now. This is how our system works. He gave me 2 years. I was supposed to go to prison for 2 years. And I asked him if I couldn't go to Stockton, the nut house down at Stockton, because the people had already evaluated and said, man, this man's crazy. You got to put him somewhere. And I knew that Stockton had a swimming pool at their nut house. And so that's where I decided I wanted to go. And he said, no, you'll go to DeWitt State Hospital. And so I was there under a criminal commitment now. Understand that, a criminal commitment. And I didn't like his place, and I went up there, and the first thing is the psychiatrist interviewed me, and he said to me, he said, do you know who the president is? And I said, well, sure, I know who the president is, and I told him who the president was. And he said, who's your senator? I said, I don't have no idea who the senator is, don't care who the senator is. He said, can you count backwards from 100 by 3? I said, well, 97, and that I couldn't go no further than that. And then he asked me a question. I was already had an intense dislike for this fellow. And he said to me, he said, have you ever wanted to have sex with your mother? And I said, I have been so sick that I haven't wanted to have sex with anybody, let alone my mother, and I hit him. And I'm telling you, it felt so good. He saw it coming, and I knew he saw it coming, and I reared back, and I was getting ready to lay one on him, and he started coming out of his chair like this, you know. And so as he was coming up this way, I hit him this way. And boy, I'll tell you, the fire flew. It was good. God, it felt good. And it got me 3 days in solitary confinement. And what they do to you at the nut house back then, they took all your clothes away. I mean, all of your clothes away. They put you in a room that had no windows, that had a light bulb about 15 feet up, just about not quite as high as this room here. And there was a one-way mirror that they could see in and you couldn't see out. And you sat there and had a drain right in the middle of the floor. And you sat there with lights on 24 hours a day, sat on the floor. And that was my introduction to the first nut house that I was ever in. And it wasn't fun. And then when they got out of there, I got on the Thorazine, and I was in there with a guy who said his dad was a king of Africa, and I didn't argue with him. I mean, he was about 7 foot tall, and he slept with his eyes open all night long. He'd sit there and he'd lay there and look at me with his eyes open like that. And right away, you know, I learned there's politics. I got elected vice president of the ward at DeWitt State Hospital because I controlled the clothing. I was a clothing monitor. And if you messed with me and you weighed 280 pounds, you got size 32 shorts. And if you weighed 120 pounds, you got size 42 shorts. And the guards they called them staff. They weren't staff, they were guards. They were all huge men that looked just like this. And they were guards. That's what they were guards. And they could care less. They could care what happened to us. I mean, it didn't matter what we did. I'll tell you one thing they did do that was very enlightening. I think this was their alcohol therapy class. They gave all of us Anabuse daily. And I don't know if you've ever had the privilege or not, but Anabuse is a nice substance that makes you rather ill if you take it and drink. And then once a week they would arbitrarily choose one of us and force feed us alcohol. And the rest of us stood around a circle and watched the person convulse and flop around on the floor like a fish. And that was our alcohol therapy for the week. And so I decided after 28 days that I ought to get out of there, and I'm on a 2-year commitment. And I just got a guy that had a buddy pass. After you're there for 3 weeks, you can walk the grounds if you get somebody that's got a blue pass or something. I don't know. But anyway, I told him to come with me. He said no. He said if I didn't, I'd kill him. So he said he'd come. And I went over the fence. I'm walking down the street with this gray sweatshirt on that said DeWitt right on the back of it. And I'm going down the street. Now, first thing I do is walk into Auburn, California, into a bar and trade my watch for a drink. Nobody said a word to me. And I called my wife and she come and got me. And you know, that hospital called all over, my uncle and my mother and everybody, and they never called my house. I only lived 28 miles from there. They finally got about 2 weeks, they called my house and asked my wife, said, have you seen your husband? Said, yeah, he's sitting right here. They said, well, good, you know, he's under a 2-year commitment. He's got to come back. We'll come and get him. She said, nothing make me happier. But there's something that I think you ought to know first. And they said, what's that? He said, he's sitting here drinking rum and taking Benzedrine, speed. And he hasn't been to bed in about 3 days and nights, and he's got a .357 Magnum pistol. And he said, he told me he's going to shoot the first one of you guys come through the door. And they said, we'll discharge him. Swear to God. I opened a treatment program in 1973, and I told my director of treatment, I said, let's write for my records and see what they say. So I signed a release information and wrote back there, and this letter came back that DeWitt State Hospital had been closed. And I was always going to go burn it down, you know. And it had been closed, but they would write to Sacramento and have my records sent. And Sacramento sent my records. And you know what it said? It said, discharged in the date, treatment success. So my treatment director, who was also my sponsor, couldn't stand it. She had to call and said, how do you classify a treatment success? It says, he never was readmitted here. She said, well, I know he was readmitted to half the places in the country. He said, don't make no difference. He never did come back here. So he's a treatment success. Now, I don't know how you go downhill from that point, but I did. Okay, I went downhill from there. And just prior to my January 1968 episode I'm going to tell you about, I was I came home one night and I had numerous suicide attempts. You know, I cut my wrist on the top. I've still got the scars here because I knew if I did cut them down here, I could die. You know, you could bleed to death. And so I cut them on the top. And what happened is I came home one night and I was looking for a knife, and my ex-wife, a wife at that time, she came out and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to kill myself. She said, good. She said, well, what are you making so much noise? I'm looking for a knife. She said, here. And she put out one of them with a serrated edge on it. Boy, that hurts. I'm going to tell you something. Don't try to cut your wrist with that kind of a knife because it does hurt a lot and it don't do no good. And you can't make it bleed. So here I was sawing on this thing and squeezing it, trying to get it to bleed, and it wouldn't bleed. And I've still got the scar. And so that was one episode. And then the next time I came home, they say alcoholism is a family disease. And I'm going to tell you something. I believe it. I came home one night in early January of 1968, and I had been out. I know it was after 2 o'clock in the morning because that's when the bars closed. My mother owned a bar, and they kicked me out of it. I thought that was not nice, but they did it. And anyway, I had been down to the bar, and I came home, and I said, I'm going to commit suicide again. So I had one of them bathrooms. You had to walk through the bedroom, you know, to get to the bathroom, and I walked through there and making all this noise in here, and I had a bottle of pills, and I had got 100 of them that day. The doctor had given them to me for hiccups. I never had the hiccups. But I acted like I did when I called him on the phone because I knew these pills really were good when you drank and took them. They were called Cyrex, and I liked them. So I'd call him and say, I got them hiccups again, Doc, and they're just driving me crazy. And so he'd order these pills for me, and I would... That doctor's in the program now in Denver. Anyway, I went home, and I know I took 97 of them because I'd taken 3 of them already that day. I remember that. And I took 97 of these pills. Now, before I did that, I want you to know I made sure the telephone was working because you know how drunks are. Sometimes their phones don't work. For some unknown reason, the telephone company unplugs them and because we have more important things to do with our money. And I made sure the phone was working, and I put it right in the corner there. So I went in the bathroom, and I threw all these aspirins all over the bathroom so it looked like, and I took 3 of them because I knew if I took a lot of aspirins, they'd kill me because I had an ulcer. And they'd just kill my stomach, so I just took 3 of them and then took 97 Cyrex, and I went in there, and I propped myself in the corner, and I called the doctor and told him what I'd done. He said, where are you? And I told him I was home. He said, good, stay right there. And I hung up, and my wife came in and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm committing suicide. And she just went back to bed. And you know, the interesting thing is pretty soon I'm sitting there and I had these visions in my head about the ambulance coming and saving me, you know, and these girls, that was back in the days of mini skirts, and these nurses coming in with their little mini skirts, you know, and when they laid me down on the gurney, I could reach down and pat them, you know, I knew I was just going to be able to do that, but no ambulance came, no nurses came. No red lights, and all of a sudden I'm getting sleepy, and I thought, Jesus, I've done it this time. And the next thing I knew, I fell over. And my wife got up to make sure I hadn't fallen on the furnace and go to stinking up the house or anything. So she called the doctor, and he said, oh, let him sleep. He'll be all right. You have to take 3 million of them things to kill you. I didn't know that. And they said, he said, one good thing about it, he'll sleep all day tomorrow. They don't know us drunks very well, because at 7 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I sat up. And when I sat up, I hit my head on something terrible bad, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, and things were coming back to me kind of, and I see these things hanging down on all sides of me, and I got looking around, and they were legs. And I had crawled under the kitchen table sometime during the night. And my kids were having breakfast. Well, you know, I laugh about that today, but how do you think that made my kids feel? How do you think my oldest daughter, who was in the sixth grade or fifth grade, felt that day when she went to school and the teacher said, "Dacre, how did things go at your house last night?" Said, "Fine, Daddy committed suicide and passed out under the table, and other than that, everything is fine, you know?" So you never hear me say I never hurt anybody but myself, because I did. I hurt everything that I came in contact with. I hurt the police departments, I hurt my family, I hurt my wife's, I hurt everything. That was kind of a low point for me, I think. You know, it was just, you know, I remember the director of the state hospital at Pueblo, Colorado, one time said that if God put him on a foreign planet with humans on there and there was nothing for alcoholics, no treatment, no nothing, and said, "Doctor, you can start one program," he said, "I'd start Al-Anon." And I believe that, he said, because if you get them Al-Anons, them drunks are going to follow, and I believe that. Because it is a family disease, and I truly, you know, I am not one of the greatest supporters of all the 12-step programs in the world, I got to tell you. Matter of fact, I've been around long enough in this program, I remember when ACA was called Al-Anon. That's a long time ago in my part of the country. And I just think there's nothing better than to see things like this, where you have families and wives and husbands, no matter who's in the program, and the young people that are here tonight. I tell you, that makes me feel so good. When Jim called me and asked me to come down here, I thought, oh, God's going to, all them people's got 40 years and 37 years and going to be all them old fuddy-duddies like Hawkins and me, you know, down there. And I'll tell you, Friday when everybody started coming, God, I started feeling good, you know, and I saw you at first and I thought, boy, you know, this is great. And I got to tell you guys, I go to AA meetings a lot of places in all over the United States and out of the country too. And I have never experienced the love that I've experienced this weekend, you know. And I have eaten with heads of state. I've dined with presidents of corporations in some of the fanciest boardrooms in the United States. I'm a vice president of a Fortune 500 company, and I've eaten lunch at the White House with the president and his wife. But I'm going to tell you something. I have never been with a better group of people than I have been here this week, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. They won't let me back at the White House, but it was interesting. I won't go into the story about all that happened, but I was invited to the White House to meet with Mrs. Reagan before she launched her war on drugs. I had no idea it was going to be just say no, or I would never had anything to do with it. But I went and I told them what I thought and everything, and they checked all my credentials and all that. And when they called me back, Miss Warblusky, President or Mrs. Reagan's personal secretary, said, "How many times have you been in jail?" I said, "You know, Ann, I don't have any idea, but if you find out, I'd love to know." You know, she said, "Well, we can't tell you any of that stuff that we divulge." But she said, "I'll tell you one thing. You are one of the most colorful people that have ever visited the White House. And when you get here, there will not be a cue stick in sight, I guarantee you." So anyway, that's how that went. January 1968, I was hurting awfully bad, and I'd got up and I had left the motel. I didn't know where I was or anything, and I got up and I noticed that I was in a motel, and I started walking, and I had to get out of there. And I went uptown, and I went to Steve's Tavern, my mother's bar, and my uncle was in there. And I said, "God, I got to have a drink. Give me a drink." And he gave me a drink, and I couldn't find my car. I didn't know where nothing was, you know. And it was January, and it was cold, and I had a T-shirt. I didn't know where my coat was. I smelled terrible, and I said, "God, we had a party last night, didn't we?" And he said, "No." I said, "Joe," I said, "I was sitting here at 1 o'clock in the morning. You said, I've got to go home because I've got to open up in the morning." He said, "Dick, that was 3 days ago. I didn't know where I'd been. I didn't know where I'd been with. You know, I'm always grateful that I'm not drunk today." I was telling Jim last night, you know, boy, if I drunk today, I'd have everything. You know, I'd be dead because I'd have AIDS 5 times. I'd have everything there is to have. I told Jim last night, I had, back in the 60s, I had everything that was available at that point in time. But at least back there, you could cure it. You know, this stuff is frightening, scares the dickens out of me. But that morning, 3 days, you know, and I found out later on because of checks that I had written that were no good, that I had been in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is 100 miles north of Denver, which is 200 miles from where I was living at the time. So it was over 300 miles to Cheyenne, Wyoming, north. And I'd went from Cheyenne, Wyoming, down through Trinidad, Colorado, and into New Mexico, and over to Dumas, Texas, and back up to Lamar, over 1,000 miles, and I don't ever remember leaving. And at the same time, there was headlines in the paper where this girl had been kidnapped, raped, and murdered. And I didn't know whether I'd done it or not. Had no idea. If they had came to me and they said, "Where were you last night?" I said, "I don't know." And I don't think they'd have bought that. And the stark terror, you know what that's like, that stark terror, did I do it? I'm looking around at my car to see if there's any clues to where I'd been when I finally found the car. Anyway, that morning, I started walking around town. And I knew that if I'd went, I left the bar immediately when he told me that, you know. And I knew if I went back downtown, I'd get drunk, I'd drink again. And I didn't know what was the matter. I didn't know it was alcoholism, I didn't know what it was. But I knew that when I drank, I got in trouble and I got sick and I didn't have any money to pay the rent. And my family hated me, and so I was just walking around, and I walked into a Catholic, not the church, but the house next to it, the rectory, is that what they call it, where the priest lives? I walked in there as a nice young man, nice young priest. He probably had never encountered anything like this in his life. And he said, "Oh my," you know, he didn't know what to do. He just talked to me for 3 hours, and he finally said, "You know, I don't know who to call. I just don't know who to call." And when I walked out, that he said, "The only thing I know to do is give you a beer, and I don't think you need that." So I said, "No, I better go." And when I walked out that morning, I said, "Boy, if I ever get over this, I swear to God, preachers and doctors and ministers and teachers and everybody else will know who to call. If somebody ever comes to them for help, they'll know who to call." And I walked out, and I got to tell you, I walked down, and God took me right to a mortuary. And this guy had been my probation officer when I was in high school. I was in trouble all the time. And when I walked in there, you know, he never asked me, "Dick, what's the matter?" Because I don't think I could have told him. He said, "Dick, sit down. I know just who to call." And have you ever heard that Hallmark saying where they care enough to send the very best? Here come this cantankerous, blind cowboy. He had glasses about that thick. His name was Floyd Sniff. Floyd had more money than Carter had liver pills. He wore old run-down cowboy boots. And he walked in, and he looked at me, and he said, "Well," he said, "the difference between you and the rest of these stiffs is that rigor mortis ain't set in on you yet." He said, "Now, we have an organization here called Alcoholics Anonymous, meets every Sunday night over at the Odds Fellows Hall." And he said, "And if you want what we got, be there." I said, "What do you got?" He said, "It's a program based on God." I thought, "Jay, that's all I need is a blind cowboy preacher." And he said, "Now, if you can't get there, if something happens to your car or something, walk." And he said, "Now, if you happen to break your leg," this was like a Wednesday or Thursday or something like that. He said, "And if you happen to break your leg, call me and we'll send somebody to get you." And I thought, "Well, God damn you, I'll stay sober, I'll show you." And I stayed sober till Sunday just on spite. And he said, "Now, where would you like to go? I'll give you a ride." And I said, "Well, can you drop me at my mother's bar?" He said, "That's just exactly what I figured." And so we go out, and you get in this big old pickup with a huge camper on it. And we get in, he starts it up, and it's January, and it is cold. He's got the air conditioning on in this pickup. And I said, "Mr. Sniff," I said, "it's cold in this pickup." He said, "I know it." I said, "Why don't you turn the heater on?" He said, "I can't read the dials." And here I'm driving down Main Street with this crazy man. That's the guy I told you about that told me always wear a tie when you talk. So I went Sunday night, and here they were. He was chairing a meeting. I thought he was a president or something. And his wife was telling this stupid story about all these drunks that come to paint their house. Said old Floyd always felt sorry for him and give him a job painting the house. Finally, she got smart and just said, paint it white. Because they might be there a day, they might be there a week, they may paint one side of it. She said she'd come home sometime and it'd be yellow and it'd be green and it'd be... She said so. Every time she could always tell there was a new guy in AA because she'd come home and somebody would be painting the house. Floyd hire him, paint the house. But I'll tell you something, they were wonderful people. But you know, something happened to me. I stayed sober 3 days and I got drunk. But I come right back to AA again. I stayed sober for 3 weeks and I got drunk. And I come right back again and I stayed sober for 6 months. And I got drunk. And that next 6 months of my drinking until April 3rd, 1969 was worse than all the rest of my drinking put together. They came to my mother's bar on the morning of April 3rd to get me. This little doctor, the one I was telling you about, who's about 5'2" and bald-headed. And I weighed 255, 57 pounds, something like that at the time. And I was a roughneck in the oil field. And my crew was sitting there with me, and I was the smallest guy on my crew. And we were all sitting in there drinking. And this little doctor came in with his lab technician, who later became my sponsor, this woman. And he said, come on, you're coming with me. I said, you go to hell. And this guy, he's jumping up and down. He's only 5'1" or 2". I mean, I'm sitting down, he's jumping up, and he still ain't as tall as I am, you know? And he said, I mean now. You'll come now. I said, well, let me finish my beer. He said, you didn't hear me. I said, now, you can either come with me or George Martin, that's a sheriff, will come and get you. So I said, all right, I'll go. So I got out in the car, and I said, where are we going? He said, you're going to the hospital. I said, well, hell, I've been there before. You know, you stay there 3 days, they give you all this medication, and the third day you can start drinking again. So it wasn't bad, and I'd been up for 5 days and nights at this time. 5 days and nights. They threw me down on the hospital bed. I carried the wheelchair in there. I didn't let them roll me in it. I carried it on my head and tried to throw the nun out the window, and that's a long story. I won't go into that. They took my boots off, and when they did, the bottoms of my stockings came off with them because I hadn't had them off in 5 days and nights. And my back, my T-shirt is all stuck to my back because I'd been stabbed, you know, and the blood was back there and everything. And I knew something was wrong. This didn't seem like the other times they had me in the hospital because they put me down there. They threw these little things over my chest and put my thumbs in them. And I thought, uh-oh. They put the railings up on my bed and they left. I started ringing that bell boy right away. I told Sister Elner, I said, where's my medication? She said, just a moment. She came back in with a pitcher of water and a plastic glass. She said, Dr. Blee said to give you all the ice water you wanted. And he left town for 3 days. No medication, no nothing. I was taking 20 hits of Benzedrine a day and drinking a quart and a half of whiskey. And I'm going to tell you something, when you crash, you crash. They wouldn't even give me an aspirin, nothing. So anyway, I laid there and I laid there for 3 days. And there was a guy that sat next to me. And I'm going to tell you, the first time I ever experienced love in my life, it was this lab tech. Her name was Louise, her husband was named Stan, and he sat beside me 24 hours a day. And every time I'd shake the side of that bed, he would reach up and put his hand on mine. And he said, I know just how you feel. Sister Eleanor came in and she saw I was so sick, she put her hand on my toe and she shook it and she said, I know just how you feel. I said, you ain't got no damn idea how I feel. None. And she didn't. She was just trying to be nice. But I knew that Stan did know how I felt, you know? And for the first time in my life, somebody was talking to me, not down at me. He was talking to me, and he was saying things like, I love you, and I thought, better watch out for this queer. I'm serious, that's what I thought. I thought I was in trouble, because I'm tied down in that bed, and he could do all kinds of terrible things to me. But I was flashing in and out, in and out, in and out, you know? And I had drank 12 quarts of tomato juice that morning before they put me in the hospital, and that does things to your digestive tract. And I had to go to the bathroom a lot with tomato juice. And Stan is a devout coward, and he tells everybody he's a devout coward. But I'll tell you, one of the greatest acts of love, when I had to go to the bathroom, he would undo my restraints, put the rail down on the side of my bed, and I'd go to the bathroom. And he was scared to death I'd kill him. I come back in one time, and like I say, I was flashing in and out, and I start cranking. We had back when they had crank beds in the hospital, and you crank it. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm trying to start this damn thing, and I'm cranking that bed." And he said, "Let me tell you about love in this program." You know what he said to me? He said, "When you get tired of cranking, let me know, and I'll crank a while." So I crawl around, get in bed, and put my hands up. He put the restraints on, and I'm laying there, and he get down, and he starts cranking. Sister Eleanor came in. She said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm trying to start this damn thing." I'd like to be able to tell you that Stan was my sponsor. Stan was my sponsor. He was. And I'd like to be able to tell you he stayed sober, but he didn't. He got drunk very, very shortly thereafter. And that was a traumatic experience to me for him to get drunk. It was awful. And he would get drunk and he'd come back in. And he would get drunk and he'd come back in. And I had to fire him as my sponsor, and I hired his wife. And let me tell you something, that's a mistake. Don't ever hire a woman as a sponsor when her husband's drinking, because they hate men, especially drunk men. But she was the best thing ever happened to me. She said, "Yes, I will, under certain conditions." I said, "What's that?" She said, "You do what I tell you to do, and you work them steps." So we got back to the AA meeting that Sunday night, and Floyd was chairing again. And Floyd said, got to the end of the meeting, he said, "Dick, do you have anything to say?" And Louise said, "No, he don't. He ain't smart enough to say anything, and when he is, I'll tell him." And after the meeting, she said, "You go talk to Floyd." And I was over talking to Floyd. I said, "Floyd, I'm having an awful time. I said, I can't stay sober." He said, "You ain't quit drinking." I hate that drunk logic. And I made a commitment right then to quit drinking. Isn't that wonderful? And I said, "Now I got another problem, Floyd." He said, "What is it?" I said, "I can't work the steps." He said, "You haven't taken the pre-step step." I said, "No, there's only 12 steps. There is no pre-step step in there anywhere." He opened the big book and he said to me, "Look here. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps." And you know what? That's right, because unless you are committed to sobriety, you are not ready to take the steps. Unless you are committed till drinking is no, or drugs are no longer an option to you, you can't take the steps. I believe that. And so I got to a point right there. I said, "I'll do anything." I said, "What do I have to do?" He said, "Nothing." He said, "You've got to be willing to go to any length." And you know, when he said that, I said, "I am willing to go." You know, I know what they mean now when they say the old timers. You know, they used to didn't let you come to AA way back, even before some of these people here came in. Way back when, you couldn't even come to AA unless you got on your knees and surrendered. And that's in effect what I did that night. I said, "God, I am willing to go to any lengths." And you know what? The steps started coming just like that. Man, I'll tell you, am I powerless? Yes. I looked up there and them teeth were gone. My kidney scar was still red. I was willing. I was powerless. I knew I was powerless. Then we got to that second one, you know, it says power greater than yourself. You know, nobody ever mentioned to me about a light bulb or a doorknob. I still got to tell you something. This is Dick Kessler. I think that's the dumbest thing in the world. Can you imagine me on my knees praying to a doorknob? Saying, "God, will you help me stay sober?" My luck, somebody'd open the door and hit me right in the head with it, you know. And I'd have taken that as an omen. Now, you know, if the doorknob's your God, more power to you. You know, I'm just telling you, my God is not like that. And I told him the other night, down here Thursday night, I didn't know what God was. I didn't have no religion. I wasn't an agnostic. I think that would have been a step up or something. I mean, I didn't have nothing. The only time I ever prayed is when there was a whole bunch of people had me cornered. And I was in deep trouble. Then I'd say, "Oh God, help me out of this one. Boy, get me, you know, whatever." But I never really thought about that as praying, you know. I mean, to me, that was a cry for desperate help of some kind. But I never prayed. I just never do those kind of things. And all of a sudden, during that 6 months I was telling you about that I drank that was so bad, I remembered something that happened to me in October 1968 on that 6 month drunk I was on. They put me in Lamar City Jail, and that jail had been built in 1898, and it was the last time it had ever been cleaned. And I was in there by myself, and there was a cell, and then over in the corner was a toilet that you had to get out of your cell. They had to let you out of your cell. It was down in the basement, and they had to let you out, and you go over there, and the only place to get a drink of water was on the other side of the toilet in the corner, and you had to lean across this toilet. And it had never been washed. I swear to God, it hadn't been washed. I was there that night, and I was so sick. It was October, and it was cold, and I had a T-shirt on and nothing else, and a pair of pants, and they took my boots, they took my belt, they took everything. They took my Rolaids, and I had an ulcer, and a kiss killing me, you know? And I crawled across there to get a drink of water, and as I was crawling back, I said, God, if I've got to live like this, let me die. 28 years old. Said, God, if I've got to live like this, please let me die. And you know, the strangest feeling came over me. I saw no flash of light. But this warmth came inside of me, and it said to me, this warmth spoke to me, and it said, Kessler, things are going to get better for you. Things are going to get better for you. And I went back and I laid on my hunk of steel. They took my mattress and all there was a plank of steel. And I laid there and I slept like a baby the rest of the night. I woke up next morning and I was hungover and they took my picture. And they turned me loose. And I'd like to tell you, I stayed sober, but I went right back to the bar and I started drinking. And during that period of time I drank, you know, from October to April, every once in a while this quiet would come over me, this sense of peace would come over me. Did you ever be in somewhere where everybody's talking and you're saying something that you just want this one person to hear and everybody shuts up and your voice is way up here and everybody hears you, you know? And that's the way it just seemed like this big quiet would come and this peace would come over me and this voice inside of me would say, Kessler, things are going to get better for you. Things are going to get better for you. I'm a roughneck in oil field. God don't come to roughnecks in oil field. He came to this one. And that morning when I woke up, after they'd put me in the hospital and I'd been there for 3 days, when I woke up and Stan Jost held my hand so I could hold an electric razor and shave, that same feeling came back to me again. That same warmth. Only it had a different message. It said to me, Kessler, you'll never take another drink as long as you live. If you do certain things. And they're very simple. And I didn't know what it was, but that's the feeling. And I swear to God, that voice came to me. Now, whether that was a hallucination or what it is, thank God for it. Because it got me back into AA, and it got me talking to Floyd Sniff, and it got me into them steps. You know, and I heard people tell me, they said, you know, there's no big deal to stay in sober 20 years. All you got to do is don't drink and don't die. But I'm going to tell you something, that ain't true. No, sir, that is not true. I stayed sober 3 days and I didn't drink and didn't die and I got drunk. And I stayed sober 3 months or 3 weeks and I didn't get drunk and I didn't die. And at the end of that time, I got drunk. And the reason was I didn't work the steps. So you got to don't drink, don't die, and work the steps. I mean, it's very simple. If you read the book, it tells you how to do it in there. And it says, then we're at step 3, and then we're at step 7, and we're at step 8, and we're at step 11. And you say, my goodness, I've done them. And I was so grateful. My little old group, that's the one thing I miss. In Denver, there's 700 meetings a week. 700 meetings a week. And I'm sure there's more than that in Atlanta, but they're all over the place. And you don't have that. In my group, they knew what step I was on, and they wanted to report weekly. And if I wasn't there, the meeting they had one night a week is all they met in Lamar, Colorado. And I was required to go 6 nights a week. So I had to drive sometimes as far as 55 miles one way to go to a meeting. Nobody ever asked me, did I want to? They just said, this is what we're going to do. And that's what I did. And every week they'd say, Louise, how's he doing? What step's he on? And I had to give a report weekly on what step I was on. 45 days into the program, I took my fifth step. I hear people say today, well, I've been sober 2.5 years now, and I'm working on step 3 real hard. Man, I'm going to tell you something. That may be great for some people. I'd have been dead duck standing here, and I would never be. Why? Well, I'd have been dead. I mean, I had the love of those people in that small group, and I had the demands and the expectations of those people. And I went on the road right away. I was sober about 30 days or less than that, actually, and I went on the road from Montgomery Ward driving a truck. And didn't know how to do much, but I knew I couldn't roughneck no more because I'd get drunk working out there with those guys, and so I had to do something else, so I drove truck. And they sent me on vacation relief, and I'd go 2 weeks here and 2 weeks there and 2 weeks here and 2 weeks there. And my sponsor, Louise, gave me this world directory, and she said, when you get to where you're going, every time you call whatever number's in this book. She said, where are you going first? And I said, Lawton, Oklahoma. So we looked it up, and she circled this name, said, call this guy right here. As soon as you get there, so I drive down there to Lawton, Oklahoma. As soon as I got there, I stopped to pay phone and call this guy. Well, it's midnight. He said, are you all right? And I said, well, yeah, I'm all right. I'm just going to stay. He said, are you drunk? I said, no. He said, well, why you call me midnight? I said, listen, my sponsor told me to call. I'm calling. And so he said, okay, where are you? And I told him, he said, where are you going to stay? And I said, well, there's a motel right here. He said, no, you're not going to stay there. Go on down about three blocks, and you turn right, do this, and that, and there's a motel down there, and the guy in the program owns it. You go there. So I went there. And he was waiting there for me. And he said, what step you on? I said, well, I don't know. I'm getting ready to work fourth. He said, good. Tomorrow night we'll start writing. And he showed up the next night, and he said, we'll go to a meeting. And we went to a meeting. And then he came in. He had a spiral notebook and a whole bunch of pencils. He said, sit down. We're going to start on this inventory business. And I thought, man, this guy's crazy. But we did it. We did it, and he showed me how to do it, and I wrote, you know, and boy, once you got into that, it was great. And what a tremendous relief. You know, when you really get into the steps, and you get into there, my wife did it with step two. With me, it was step three, when it says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Okay, fine. Then the next one, it says, turn the direction to me, what it says, is turn the direction of my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And once that God's got the direction of my life, the steps aren't hard to do. Because why should you be afraid? You got God right there. And he's showing you how to do step six and seven. And there's only a paragraph each in the book about them. That's no big deal. And then you get down to the steps. Eight and nine. I'm going to tell you something. All that other stuff up to this point has been between you and one other person and God. But when you get down there to the big boy steps, that's the one I think separates the men from the boys. That's where you got to go out and knock on doors and talk to people and say, this is what I did, and I'm sorry. That's where you got to start facing the world. And to me, that's what liberates you. It's no secret or no coincidence that the promises come at a specific point in the book after you have worked certain steps. And after you get done with step nine, it says, if you've done a pretty good job at this, here's what's going to happen. And it outlines it for you. And here's the promises. All these fears are going to be gone and this and that. And it's so simple, it's not even funny. You know, and I remember I was sober about a year. Oh no, I wasn't even sober a year, not quite a year, about 9 months. And the teacher came to me, sixth grade teacher came to me and said, I was working at a Gibson Discount Center, and said to me, said, Dick, would you come and speak to my class about alcoholism? I said, well, I don't know about that. I said, all I know is what it did to me. He said, well, I mean, that's all we got. They didn't have anybody else in Lamar, Colorado. And I said, well, you know, I'll have to ask my daughter because she's in that class. He said, fine. So that night we're at home eating dinner. And I said, Dacra, I said, your teacher came to see me today. She said, yeah, I know, he said he was going to. I said, well, he wants me to come and talk to your class about alcoholism. She said, yeah, I know. I said, well, I told him I couldn't do it unless I talked to you. She put her fork down and looked at me. She said, talk to me about what? I said, well, I wouldn't want to embarrass you. She said, Daddy, people in this town have seen your name in the paper for drunken disorderly, resisting arrest, inciting riots. They've seen you crawl down Main Street, and you think that it would embarrass me for you to come to my school sober? And I haven't quit going to school since. I imagine I've spoken to a quarter of a million students in junior and senior high school since that time. I've never forgotten that. He said, Daddy, you think that it would make me embarrassed to see you sober? So today, it's basically step 12, 11, and 10 is a struggle for me sometimes, because I do have just a little bit of ego, not much, but a little bit. And step 10 is a little difficult for me, but I try to work it. A wonderful thing happened to me when I was sober about a year and a half. This guy, you know, when I first sobered up and I got off the road to Montgomery Wards, I come back to Lamar, and this guy said to me, he said, I want you to go to work in my discount center, Gibson Discount Center. I'd never worked in a store in my life. I'd worked in the sawmills and the mines and been a bouncer and a cowboy and dealt blackjack and did everything there was to do, and but nothing like that. And I said, well, I don't know, Lee. He said, well, I want you to sell guns and sporting goods and electronics on a commission basis. I said, all right, I'll try it. And he gave me the keys to the store, the combination to the safe. Been out of jail 30 days. And what he gave me was not the keys to the store. He gave me faith. He trusted me. And we had to have lie detector tests. And here come this guy to give all everybody in the store lie detector tests. And it come my turn. He gave me a lie detector, and I failed it miserably. And I'm zealot, you know. I mean, I'm going to sober up the world. And this guy has the audacity to say that I'm drinking. And, you know, I took three of them that day. And finally, the third one, I called Mr. Weeks. I said, Lee, you got to come in here because this guy, I want you in here when he gives me this test. And he got done, and he looked at Lee Weeks, and he said, Mr. Weeks, he said, I hate to tell you this, but Dick Kessler is stealing from you. He's using drugs, and he's drinking. Mr. Weeks says, pack that stupid machine up and get out of here. He said, well, what do you mean? He said, if Dick Kessler was drinking, I wouldn't need no damn machine to tell me. He said, everybody in southeastern Colorado, no. He said, so get it out of here. You know, I found out later, I was talking to a psychologist, and he said, it's not unusual for drunks to feel that guilt. My sponsor said, oh, yeah, that's true. Said, because when she worked at the doctor's office, if they look at the petty cash and it's 3 cents short, she's going to think, oh, God, they think I stole it, you know. And she wants to run and get the money and put it back. She didn't even have nothing to do with it. So particularly in that early stage until we get through that steps, we have terrible guilt all the time. So if somebody said, did you do that? And you say, yeah, I don't know, I probably did. Or if I didn't, I probably thought about it, you know. And it just goes on like that. But one day, Lee, I was sober just a little over a year, and Lee Weeks, I'll tell you about my first birthday first, and then I'm going to tell you about Lee Weeks, and then I'm going to shut up. My first birthday, I was sitting there in this little town, Lamar, and there's about 10 members in our group, and there was about 40 people at that meeting. The chief of police was there. The judge was there. The district judge and the county judge, the sheriff was there, a lawyer, a minister, and they were all taking credit for my sobriety. And they all had a part in it, let me tell you. They close those doors until you close those doors. I'm going to keep going through them, you know, until they shut them. That judge said to me, he said, if you ever come back in my court, I'd hit a cop right in his court one time. He said, if you ever come back in my court on an alcohol-related offense, I'll put you in jail for so damn long you'll forget what light sunlight looks like. And I knew he meant it. I could tell by looking at him, he meant it. So they were all there, and you know what? The chief of police gave me a picture. It was my last mugshot taken in October 1968, the morning after God came to me in that jail cell. One of the most prized possessions I have. And if you look at that picture, you say, who is that guy? And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed that person. That's not even true. Has erased that person, because that person no longer exists. I guarantee you the person that's standing here tonight is not that person that's in that picture. And I don't care what anybody says. My daughter, my middle daughter, came in one time. I was sober about 8, 6, 7 years. She looked up on my office wall, and there sits that picture. She said, Daddy, who is that? She didn't even recognize me. That person don't think the same. That person does not have the same value system. That person does not have anything, nothing in comparison to that person. I guarantee you. And I work in a field that people got diplomas. I got kicked out of high school for cheating, you know. I never got any kind of diploma. And yet I got this mugshot hanging on my wall. And when my office was in Washington, D.C., you ought to have seen the looks I got. People come in and had a beautiful office on the Potomac. You could see the White House and everything out there. And they come in and they look and say, what is that? And I said, that's my mugshot. They look at me like I was crazy. So that was my first birthday. And old Lee Weeks came to me about a year, or about two or three months after that, about a year and a quarter after my sobriety, and he said, tell me, Dick, he said, what's the worst thing in the world happened to you? Well, I said, worst thing in the world happened to me, I get fired. He said, how many jobs you had? And I said, well, hell, I don't know. He said, alcoholics, I can take you, an alcoholic can take you in a strange, dry county, take every penny away from you, take your watch away from you, put you on a street corner at 8 o'clock Sunday morning, and by 9:30 you'll be drunk. Now, don't tell me that you couldn't find another job. So, okay, I guess that's true. I could find another job. I had hundreds of jobs when I was drinking. Well, the worst thing in the world happened to me is I could get put in jail. He said, you've been in jail so many times. I said, that's right. That's not the worst thing. Oh, I'd lose my wife. He said, the woods is full of wives. You can always find another wife. And I found a few along the way. And it dawned on me what he's talking about. The worst thing that could happen to me was I could drink. He said, that's right. Because then all those things would happen to you, wouldn't they? The jail, the loss of your family, the loss of your kids, the loss of yourself. And he started to walk away, and he turned right back to me, and he said, now tell me one other thing. I said, what's that? He said, who can do that to you? I said, who can do what? He said, who can do the worst thing in the world that can happen to you? Who can do it to you? I said, well, me? He said, isn't that wonderful? You need to fear no man that walks. You need to fear no situation. You need to fear nothing. Because the worst thing in the world that can happen to you, only you can do to yourself. And that's brought me a freedom. That's brought me an understanding. That's brought me God. That's brought me a life today that I never dreamed possible. I fear no man that walks. I fear no situation. I don't have to worry about going on 12-step calls. I don't have to worry about going into a bar. If my motives are correct. I don't have to worry about people putting the wrong drink down on the table. I don't have to worry about any of those kind of things. Because the only person in the world that can do all the things to me that are the worst is me. And I know that as long as I keep God in perspective, keep my spiritual program intact, that won't happen. Thank you very much.